Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. We're going to be taking you through several days of news coverage on Israel's assault on Gaza, featuring interviews with Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies and Josh Rubner, National Advocacy Director at the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. Our coverage on Gaza began with a December 26 interview with UN Special Rapporteur to the Palestinian Territories, Richard Falk, about dire conditions in Gaza due to Israel's blockade, preventing even humanitarian supplies from being delivered by the UN and other agencies. Falk has appealed to the UN Security Council, asking them to pressure Israel to allow humanitarian aid into Gaza to save lives there. He had also called on the ICC, International Criminal Court, asking them to investigate Israel's violation of the ceasefire in November.
Just a couple of weeks ago, Israel broke the truce by using force to kill some Palestinians in a quite flagrant violation of the truce, and that led to a Hamas response by way of rockets, which, as I've also indicated, is an unlawful and immoral tactic on the part of the Palestinians. It's something of a crime of survival, but still it is a crime and should be condemned as such.
Shortly after that interview aired, Israeli troops began bombing Gaza, moving troops and heavy artillery in for a possible ground attack. Between 390 and 400 Palestinians have died in these air attacks, with many wounded. We turn to Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. on December 28th to learn more about what was going on. Phyllis Bennis, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks very much. Good to be with you.
David Swanson has posted a piece online by you, The Gaza Emergency, at afterdowningstreet.org. Just give us an update on Gaza and an overview of your piece.
The one thing that is widely understood at this point is that the humanitarian consequences of this invasion are explosive, horrific, and worse than anything we've seen probably since 1967 in the region. The number of people killed on a daily basis is staggering. There's now more than 300 people who are already known dead. 1,300 have been treated at hospitals, treated as best they can, since the hospitals are woefully not just understaffed, but out of medicine, without sufficient access to electricity because of the long siege that Israel has imposed on the Gaza Strip. What's not as clear, because of the way it's being portrayed in the international press, is that the Israeli airstrikes constitute a massive set of violations of international law, the Geneva Conventions, among others. These violations include collective punishment. Granted that the rocket fire from, at least that rocket fire which is aimed at civilian cities inside Israel, is indeed illegal, it doesn't give the Israelis the right to punish the entire 1.5 million Gazan citizens, including the 50% of those, 750,000 of whom are children, for the actions of a few militants. Another violation is that of directly targeting civilians. The Israelis claim first that the strikes were targeted at so-called security institutions, police agencies, etc. Those are, in fact, civilian targets. They're not the military. And, in fact, I think everyone knows that the military wing of Hamas is completely separate from the governing structures in which Hamas is the dominant party of police and other security agencies. Additionally, there have been direct attacks on what are indisputably civilian targets, including the university, television broadcasting center, two hospitals, a plastics factory, as well as a number of houses. And then the third part of this notion of targeting civilians simply goes to the nature of Gaza. The Gaza Strip is the most densely populated place on Earth. It's about 4,200 people per square kilometer, more than anywhere else in the world. And to think that you can carry out, quote, targeted bombings using U.S.-supplied F-16 fighter bombers to carry out something that will not massively destruct civilians in the adjacent areas is purely nonsense. A third violation involves how disproportionate this attack was. Again, the Israelis have no right, as the occupying power, to use this kind of military force against a protected population, the occupied population, for whom they have clear obligations under the Geneva Conventions. even if one accepted their, what I believe to be, false claim of self-defense, and we should note that this has not made Israelis safer. The two Israelis that have been killed in the last 2 days are the first killed in more than a year by these Palestinian rockets. So it has actually made Israelis more vulnerable, not less. But even if one accepted that argument, the disproportionate nature of this attack, killing more than 300 people so far, injuring more than 1,300 so far, we don't know how many dozens, scores, or hundreds are already also dead and not known yet, buried under the rubble of the buildings across the Gaza Strip that have been destroyed. This is not acceptable. This kind of disproportionate attack is itself a violation. So there are massive violations. We also should note that the U.S. is directly and indirectly complicit in these attacks. It's directly complicit in that the equipment that makes possible these attacks, the F-16 fighter bombers, the Apache helicopters, the TOW missiles, a whole host of other parts of Israel's aggressive military arsenal, have been provided directly by the United States through the $3 billion plus every year in military aid that the U.S. provides to Israel. That aid violates both U.S. law, domestic law, specifically the Arms Export Control Act, which defines quite narrowly the terms in which U.S.-provided arms can be used. And, of course, it violates international law. Given that the U.S. knows both the history of Israeli practices, the history of violations, which have ironically been documented by the State Department itself, but also the fact that they knew about this particular attack days before it was carried out, makes them directly complicit. Now, the U.S. government is also indirectly complicit through its protection of the Israeli position. By using the veto, threatening to use the veto in the Security Council, the U.S. has made sure, historically, and did it again with this attack, that nothing that happens in the United Nations can actually hold Israel accountable for its violations. So in that protection of these illegal acts and these actions that are designed to protect Israel from being held accountable, the U.S. government itself remains complicit in the violations of these attacks.
What has been the response of the U.N. Security Council to the kinds of complaints being made by Richard Falk, U.N. Special Rapporteur for Human Rights on the Occupied Territories and others?
There's been very little response from the Council. The Council, of course, is paralyzed because of the U.S. veto and the veto of the other four permanent members. And it's been clear that the position of the Council is going to be dominated by political considerations and the interests of the powerful countries of the world. It's for that reason that Richard Falk and others, including Father Miguel Descoto, who is currently the president of the General Assembly, are looking to the Assembly as the more appropriate venue for taking up the issue of protection of Palestinians. There's been a great deal of discussion in the UN over the last couple of years about the so-called responsibility to protect, something that's abbreviated as R2P, responsibility to protect. And there's been a great deal of unease about this notion in many countries around the world because of the fear that it will be used as an excuse to justify interventions by the U.S. and other powerful countries in the name of so-called protection, a version of what used to be known as humanitarian intervention. The interesting thing now is that the question of protection of Palestinians is very much on the agenda, and it may be that the best way to challenge the expected double standards and hypocrisy that are feared in how the responsibility to protect may be instituted at the UN, the best way to challenge that may well be to demand that the responsibility to protect, or R2P, be imposed for the Palestinians, to protect the Palestinians against Washington's best friend in the region, that being Israel, the occupying power. Now, whether the General Assembly is prepared to move on that, we don't know yet. There has been a statement from both Richard Falk, the Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, on Saturday, and another one on Saturday by Father Miguel Descoto, both of whom identified the violations of international law and spoke of the particular obligations of the United Nations to take its independent responsibility for dealing with these kinds of violations. Both of them have identified the obligations of the UN, and in Richard Falk's case, he reminded the member states that the UN is, in his words, bound by an independent obligation to protect any civilian population facing massive violations of international law, regardless of what country may be responsible for those violations. He then went on to call on member states of the UN as well as officials and the relevant organs of the UN system, to, quote, move on an emergency basis not only to condemn Israel's serious violations, but to develop new approaches to providing real protection for the Palestinian people. In Father Miguel's statement, he also spoke of the particular obligations of the United Nations to respond to this on an urgent basis. He may have another statement issued tomorrow. And I think there is a possibility that the General Assembly may be called into emergency session responding to the failure of the Security Council, who met yesterday but issued an almost useless, perhaps even more dangerous than useless, statement that did not identify any violations of international law by the Israelis, that called on both sides as if they were equally culpable to stop the violence, that spoke of the need to provide for the humanitarian needs of the Palestinian people, but without identifying Israeli responsibility to open the closed border zones, did not call on Egypt to open the Rafah crossing. There was no specificity in the identifying of who was responsible and what must be done to change the situation.
Israeli official Tzipi Livni is running for the office of prime minister against former PM Benjamin Netanyahu. She was one of the first voices Americans heard from after Israel launched attacks on Gaza. Livni telling NBC's David Gregory Israel wanted to change the realities on the ground.
Since Gaza Strip is being controlled by Hamas, and since Hamas is using Gaza Strip in order to target us, we need to give an answer to this.
Foreign Minister, aren't you making the case for pushing Hamas from power? The ceasefire, according to Israel, simply hasn't worked. It hasn't stopped the bombing of Sderot and Israel in the southern areas. So only the replacement of Hamas by Fatah, by more moderate leaders, appears to be the only answer.
The goal is to give an answer to our citizens, to give them the possibility to live in peace like any other citizen in the world, and Hamas need to understand it.
We asked Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies to comment on Livni's call for a new reality in Gaza.
What Tzipi Livni really refers to when she says she wants to change the reality is changing the perception that emerged after the 2006 war in Lebanon, in which Israel emerged as the loser. Hezbollah in that situation emerged having taken extraordinary casualties, but nonetheless seen as a political victor. It strengthened them politically in the elections and in other pieces of evidence of support for Hezbollah inside Lebanon. There has been a sense that Israel is not invincible. That was the lesson for many of the Lebanon war. And there has been a claim in Israel from Tzipi Livni and others that that's what needs to change, that they must go back to Israel being feared. Now, I don't think, in fact, that there was ever a moment when Israel was not feared in the region. It has by far the largest and most powerful military. It's one of course, the most powerful military forces and one of the largest in the world. It's also the only nuclear power in the region. Israel, of course, is the only country in the Middle East that has a nuclear weapons stockpile of between 200 and 400 high-density nuclear weapons in its Dimona plant. But there is a perception inside Israel, because there have been these occasional rocket attacks, which have killed very, very few people, luckily. I mean, certainly these rocket attacks not only do nothing to end the occupation of Gaza or the West Bank and are violations of international law, but they don't serve any real military purpose or any other. They've luckily killed fewer than 8 people in the past 6 years, I think it is. You know, the numbers are very, very tiny, but they are hugely focused on as a point of justification for Israel's move, in this case against Gaza. We should note that over the last 24 hours, there has been escalating Israeli military attacks in the West Bank as well. One Palestinian has been killed in the West Bank. There have been numbers of people injured seriously by so-called rubber bullets, which are actually metal balls the size and shape of marbles but coated with a piece of rubber, and by tear gas in massive demonstrations of Palestinians across the West Bank. There have been no rockets fired from the West Bank. That has not prevented the escalation of both military and social constraints of the occupation. So this notion that this is all just in response to rocket fire is simply spurious.
Now, in the days leading up to Israel's air attack on Gaza, there were stories about divisions within Hamas, and some leaders in Hamas were actually calling for a return to the ceasefire, offering to go back to the ceasefire terms.
There's always been a variety of views within Hamas, as there is within any large mass-based political party. There are two definable trends, and there's lots of other opinions within it. One, which tends to be more powerful in the external forces within Hamas, those based in Hamas headquarters in Damascus, but others around the world as well, that have been more supportive of the military wing, the Izz ad-Din al-Qassam brigade that has carried out the rocket fire and the other military attacks over the years. Another wing which has more predominance, I think, inside Gaza and includes some of the leaders of the governing structures who were elected with a strong majority. This is not some outside force that has come in. And those forces, I think, tend to be more eager to reimpose the ceasefire, which, despite fraying around the edges, largely held for the last 6 months until a few days before its expiration on December 26th, when Israel began a serious campaign of efforts to provoke Palestinian reactions. There was some provocation, there were some rocket fires, and Israel used that as the basis to announce that the ceasefire was over. Hamas went to Cairo, met with the Egyptians, as did Tzipi Livni. It was clear she did not accept with any seriousness the Palestinian proposal, which was to renegotiate a new ceasefire, extend the ceasefire, based on Israel's willingness to open the borders of Gaza, to allow food and medicine and fuel to come in and out and to allow people in and out. We shouldn't forget that for 2 years, Gazans have been essentially imprisoned in the Gaza Strip, with Israel maintaining complete control over all border crossings, and the only goods that have come in have been either through the secret tunnels that have been dug under the Egyptian border that have been able to be used for smuggling in flour and medicine, etc., and the five so far arrivals of the Free Gaza boats that have brought international human rights defenders and very small amounts of humanitarian supplies from Cyprus, and of course have also been used to take some Palestinian students in particular and patients needing advanced medical care out of Gaza who could not otherwise get out, either to continue their studies internationally or to find necessary medical care.
Where could this be leading? We've seen a lot of reaction.
I don't think we know where it's leading. I think what we do know is that the situation is getting worse and worse. The rocket fire has gotten somewhat more powerful. It certainly doesn't seem to be aimed any more clearly. At least one rocket did go as far as the edge of Ashkelon, which is farther than rockets have in the past. This is not helping anybody, obviously. Getting stronger military forces on the Palestinian side is not helping. But clearly there's a large divide at the governmental level across the Middle East, with some governments allied with the U.S. and against their own populations, particularly the governments in the Gulf, governments like Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, others that are allied with the U.S., but face populations that are outraged at what the U.S.'s allies in the region are doing in Gaza, and governments like Syria and Iran, which are supporting forces like Hezbollah or Hamas, but have their own problems at home. So it's a very contested region.
Phyllis Bennis is a senior fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and steering committee member at the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. She is author of Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, a Primer. Phyllis Bennis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
As of early December 30th, day 4 of Israel's air assault on Gaza, web pages of network news outlets were featuring Gaza slideshows with portraits of dead or dying children. U.S.-based news networks like ABC continued to report that Israel's attacks were in retaliation for violations of the ceasefire by Hamas. They didn't mention Israel's violations of the ceasefire, which in this case did come first. World leaders like Germany's Angela Merkel were blaming Hamas for Israel's attacks.
Protesters opposed to the Israeli military option took to the streets throughout the Middle East today and beyond. In Iraq, protesters burned the Israeli flag, while in Athens, demonstrators fought with police. There were other protests in Europe, including Britain and Germany, although German Chancellor Angela Merkel put the blame squarely on Hamas for breaking a ceasefire with Israel. That same position has been echoed by the White House, which has condemned Hamas's rocket attacks on Israel.
Israel's media quoted Prime Minister Ehud Olmert as saying the Gaza offensive was in the first of several stages. The French tried to step in and offer a ceasefire option for Israel and Hamas. French Foreign Minister Bernard Kouchner proposed a 48-hour truce to allow aid into Gaza. Israel thought about it overnight, they said, but rejected it. Their targets now included 5 ministerial buildings, several mosques, and a building owned by the Islamic University in Gaza City. We spoke with Josh Rubner, National Advocacy Director at the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, about his group's efforts to promote a peaceful solution. Josh Rubner, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like your comment on steady reports now in the U.S. media that Israel is retaliating for violations of the ceasefire by Hamas. There's been no mention of violations by Israel, little or no discussion about the blockade that's been causing starvation in Gaza.
Well, it's true that Hamas has been getting more and more sophisticated weaponry into the Gaza Strip. Its rockets are having more and more of an impact and more of a range. What to me is very disturbing in this coverage is that instead of sticking to principles of human rights and international law, the U.S. government and the press have tended to take sides, saying that Hamas's rocket attacks on Israel are illegal and illegitimate. And let me say that it's always illegal and illegitimate to attack civilian population centers. But if that's the case, and if that's the principle, then the same thing needs to hold true for Israel's actions. And Israel's actions are having a much, much bigger impact, and of course it's being done solely with U.S. weapons. Israel's attack on the Gaza Strip could not take place without the jets, the helicopters, the fuel, the missiles, the spare parts that we as U.S. taxpayers provide to Israel.
Well, the UN's Special Rapporteur for the Palestinian Territory, Richard Falk, told us he was in the process of trying to get the ICC, International Criminal Court, to investigate Israel's violation of the ceasefire, that just prior to Israel's assault on Gaza. What do you make of the news blackout on that story?
Richard Falk is absolutely correct in his assessment on this. An unofficial, indirect ceasefire was negotiated through the good offices of Egypt over the summer between Israel and Hamas. These were indirect negotiations. It was a limited duration, 6-month truce. And on November 4th, the day of the elections in the United States, when, of course, the attention of the whole world was focused elsewhere, the Israeli army made 2 large-scale attacks, ground attacks, into the Gaza Strip, in the northern part and the central part of the Gaza Strip, which killed approximately 4 to 6 members of Hamas and also 1 civilian who took no part in hostilities. So that was a clear provocation and breach of the terms of the truce. But really, more importantly, the truce was also supposed to ensure access of humanitarian goods into the Gaza Strip. And what the civilian population of Gaza is facing right now as a result of this siege is a form of collective punishment. In other words, the entire civilian population of the Gaza Strip is being punished for the actions of people who are firing rockets into Israel. And under international law, under the Geneva Conventions, it's always illegal and a war crime to commit acts of collective punishment. You can't be punished for acts of another person under international law, which is what Israel is doing by denying the access of food, clean water, electricity, fuel, medicine, etc., into the Gaza Strip. So the fact that the truce happens and the siege that Israel has imposed on the Gaza Strip only tightened up during the truce is another reason why it broke down, I believe.
Everyone waited for President-elect Barack Obama to say something about Israel's bombing of Gaza, but he seemed to be couching his answers, you know, not coming out with a strong statement yet anyway that would offer further pressure either on Israel or Hamas to accept the ceasefire.
I can understand the transition team's hesitance to speak out, and they've been hesitant to speak out on a number of issues, saying that there's only one president at a time, and the fact that he's not in power yet, I can understand where he's coming from on that. But certainly, people in the United States need to be outraged that our weapons, our taxpayer dollars, are being used to fund Israel's atrocities and massacres and blatant human rights violations of the Palestinian people, not only in the Gaza Strip, but the West Bank as well. And we have an open letter to President-elect Obama, which has been signed by thousands and thousands of individuals and hundreds of organizations around the country, demanding that we need a change as well in policy towards Israel-Palestine, because we've seen for the past 60 years now that our one-sided, unconditional support for Israel's violations of Palestinian human rights has not produced peace, has not produced justice, has not produced security for either Israelis or Palestinians, and we need a fundamentally new principle for our policy, one that supports human rights, international law, and equality for everyone. And if people are interested, they can go to our website to sign the open letter to the president-elect, which is www.endtheoccupation.org.
What should Barack Obama do, in your opinion?
The absolute first thing that the Obama administration should do is hold Israel accountable for its misuse of U.S. weapons. Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. weapons, and in 2007, there was an agreement conducted to increase those arms transfers by 25% to cover $30 billion worth of arms over the next decade. In the United States, there are clear rules for how U.S. weapons can and cannot be used by foreign governments. And these laws are governed under the Arms Export Control Act and the Foreign Assistance Act. And those laws state that U.S. arms cannot be used for offensive military actions, which is exactly what Israel is doing right now, can only be used for internal security or for policing purposes. So when we see the F-16s, when we see the Apache helicopter gunships, when we see the naval patrol boats shooting missiles into the Gaza Strip, all that's being done with U.S. weapons in violation of U.S. law. And according to our research, and this doesn't even take into account any of the casualties from this most recent war on the Gaza Strip, but through November of 2008, more than 2,000 Palestinians who took absolutely no part in hostilities, civilians, were killed by Israel, oftentimes with U.S. weapons. So the Obama administration really needs to take a hard look at this policy of sending these weapons to Israel with our taxpayer dollars and to impose the sanctions under U.S. law that are required for countries that violate these laws and commit human rights abuses with U.S. weapons.
If both sides were to respect the ceasefire, would that be a suitable beginning, the ceasefire as it's been written, through the courtesies of Egypt?
Absolutely. I think an immediate ceasefire is what's absolutely needed in the short term, and I would hope and pray that that's accomplished way before President-elect Obama takes office.
Well, Meet the Press anchor David Gregory of NBC said Israel was criticized for not using sufficient force against Gaza and Lebanon. So we're talking about Hamas and Hezbollah. This was in a promo for his show. What could be the downside of that kind of thinking and of this level of force?
It's really a fundamental mistake in thinking of the media and of military officials that might makes right in the first place and that more might will produce better outcomes. In the case you referred to of Lebanon back in 2006, Israel's month-long war on Lebanon killed approximately 1,000 people, the vast, vast majority, probably around 90% of whom were civilians. And these war crimes committed against the people of Lebanon did not produce any tangible gains for Israel. It did not make Israel safer. It did not destroy the infrastructure of Hezbollah. In fact, it caused quite a lot of gains in terms of their political stature. And the idea that you can take a political movement like Hamas, which legitimately won the 2006 legislative elections. Everyone viewed these elections as free and fair. The idea that you can destroy this political movement through massive attacks and human rights violations and war crimes is not only immoral and illegal, but it absolutely has the opposite effect of what's intended. And we're seeing that by Israel targeting schools and other civilian infrastructure right now in the Gaza Strip, that sympathy is being generated for Hamas amongst Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. So, you know, the idea that more of this will somehow cause Palestinians to submit to Israeli will, somehow cause Palestinians to deny themselves their own individual and collective human rights and submit to eternal Israeli apartheid, which is what's being practiced against them, is a fundamentally mistaken notion. People who are dispossessed, who are denied their human rights to liberty, to independence, to freedom, to equality, they're always going to resist. They're always going to resist. So the idea that this can be put down through war crimes in the form of overwhelming military might is fundamentally mistaken.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Josh Rubner is National Advocacy Director at the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. His webpage is endtheoccupation.org. His group plans over 100 protests within some 30 states and 65 cities across the U.S., calling for an end to Israel's attacks on Gaza. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced at the studios of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.